Hi, I'm Andrew Barabas, and I'm going to talk about my work this summer on interdigital transducers and their applications to hybrid quantum devices. So our main motivation in pursuing these devices is to advance the field of quantum computation and quantum communication. So I'll give a brief introduction on that. So in a classical computer, we make use of classical bits, which can be set in a state of 0 or 1. But a quantum computer uses quantum bits, or qubits, and because those follow the laws of quantum mechanics, we can set them in a superposition of 0 and 1. So the qubits can be in a state of 0 and 1 simultaneously. And what this allows is for a system of entangled qubits. Essentially, you can encode all possible states into the input, which makes for a sort of parallel processing. It's called quantum parallelism. And quantum algorithms make use of this quantum parallelism to make certain computations much faster than their classical counterparts. So some examples are Shor's algorithm, which is good for factorizing large numbers, or Grover's algorithm for searching through large unsorted databases. So another important application of quantum computers is quantum simulation. Quantum simulation is very difficult for a classical computer to do because the information contained in a quantum system scales exponentially with its size. So you would need an exponential amount of resources if you were to model a quantum system using a classical computer. And this is where quantum computers would really outdo classical computers, since they're also quantum systems. So let's get into the architecture of these devices. Just as a classical computer has different types of bits for memory and processing, a quantum computer will also need to have different types of bits. So we want longer-lived qubits for memory, such as the nitrogen vacancy center in Diamond, and more quickly manipulatable qubits for processing, for example, superconducting qubits. Now, we also need to link these quantum systems somehow. And for that, we introduce another type of qubit, a flying qubit, to transmit information between these two quantum devices, or these two stationary qubits. Traditionally, the photon has been used as a flying qubit, and it's been used to demonstrate entanglement between various stationary qubits, but we're interested in using a phonon. So a phonon is just a quantized lattice vibration, and essentially it's just a sound wave in a material. And it has various advantages over a photon in that it has a smaller wavelength, so we can make smaller devices and fit more of them inside a single chip. Mechanical excitations are also well confined to their material, so we're not going to have loss to vacuum, and it minimizes crosstalk as compared to a photon. So the way phonons interact with different types of qubits is via a mechanical quantum bus. So here I have a cartoon of a mechanical quantum bus interacting with various types of qubits through different forces. But we're focused on embedded qubits interacting via stress and strain, and charged qubits with electrical force, i.e. Specifically the NV center and superconducting qubits. So the actual mechanical excitation that we're interested in for this is a surface acoustic wave. And as the name suggests, a surface acoustic wave is some mechanical wave that's confined near the surface of material, and it exhibits some transverse and longitudinal displacement as it passes through the material. So here I have a simulation we've made of a standing surface acoustic wave in a material where this color scale indicates the displacement from equilibrium. And when one of these waves travels through a material, it's deforming the material and placing some strain on it. So that's how it can interact with our NV center via strain. And in order to make these surface acoustic waves in a material, we also need the material to be piezoelectric, which provides a method to couple to these superconducting charge qubits. So let me get into what piezoelectricity is. The basic gist of piezoelectricity is you have some material that, if you apply a strain to it, it'll result in some electric field, or if you apply an electric field across the material, it'll result in strain in the material. So we deal with this pretty much every day. If you ever use one of those lighters that makes like a clicking sound when you ignite it, you're straining some piezoelectric element, creating some voltage difference across two leads, and that voltage results in some arc and ignites the gas. So how does this relate to surface acoustic waves? Well, so that's the material that we have in order to make our surface acoustic waves. But on top of the material, we need an interdigital transducer, which consists of two electrodes with these digits interwoven with each other. They're interdigitated. And here's a view from the side. You have one digit here and one digit here on top of this piezoelectric material. So when we apply some electric signal across these electrodes, we get a field inside the material, and because the material is piezoelectric, that results in some displacement in the material. And because we have periodic fingers for our IDTs, that constructively interferes to make a surface acoustic wave at a wavelength defined by the separation of the digits. So here are kind of diagrams of our devices. We have electrodes on top with a thin film of aluminum nitride and bulk diamond or silicon beneath that. So actually, here's images of our devices looking closer. You can see the individual digits coming out of each one. So we need to actually measure the surface acoustic waves of these IDTs, and we do that using laser Doppler vibrometry, which is basically interferometry on these devices. So we have a laser, goes through a beam splitter. This measurement beam goes to the sample where it incurs some phase shift as a result of displacement on the surface, and Doppler shift as a result of the surface velocity, because our surface is vibrating. So we combine this back with our reference beam and interfere it onto a detector. So this is actually a measurement that we haven't made before in our lab. So we wanted to start off with a very simple system to take a look at. So we have these diamond cantilevers, which are basically just diving boards that vibrate up and down when they're driven, or they also actually exhibit a very small Brownian motion. So we made some measurements while driving them and worked to reduce noise sources in our measurement, and eventually we were actually able to image the Brownian motion of these cantilevers. So we have very small Lorentzian line shape at the frequency that we expect for our cantilevers. So we've just started now making measurements on our aluminum nitride on silicon IDTs, but these measurements take a long time, and we have just some very rough responses from them so far. So in our future work, we need to work to remove these noise sources and get a nice smoother response from them. So I'd like to thank the Worcester family for their funding this summer, Ani Jaich, our PI, for her help, Jeff Cady, my graduate mentor, and Kenny Lee, another graduate student in our group, for their help. And I'd also like to thank Kimberly Foster for the use of her lab's LDV, and Brian Gibson for helping me set up the LDV, or use it. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you can answer this. You talked about memory of quantum computers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, I mean, quantum memory just doesn't sound that stable to me. Do you know anything about that?
The stability varies with the qubit that you have, but in the case of NV centers, the coherence time, the measurement of like how long it'll retain information, can be as long as milliseconds, but in practice this isn't always the case. There's other systems like trapped ions that have experienced coherence times of on the order of hours, but they're generally much harder to interact with because they're so isolated.
On your diamond cantilever plot. I was wondering what sort of uncertainties you have, because it's the y-axis is picometers, so that's like really small. Do you have
yes.
a resolution for that?
The device that we're using is it's a commercial device, and it was set up by some people in an engineering lab, so we don't have access to that currently, but that's on the list of things to extract the uncertainties for these data points.
On your next graph, what are the like sources of noise in this picture, and how can you improve this?
That is a very good question. So actually, this measurement here, this measurement is 500 averages, and we were able to only do it in 15 or 20 minutes because we were using Brownian motion, so we didn't have to drive our cantilever and then measure a peak at a particular frequency. But with the IDTs, we have to drive at each individual frequency to get a data point. So it's like, if we wanted to get 500 averages, it would be like 15 minutes per individual point. So actually, this scan took like 6 hours, and this is, I think it was 25 average. No, this is 10 averages. Or 3 hours, it 10 averages. So it takes a really long time. That's my first guess at this.
Further questions? Let's thank Andrew. Well, I think we're just doing the next person over the next 2 minutes.